I'm Donna Edwards. Thank you for joining us today on Woman to Woman, Let's Talk Leadership. As a woman of color and former member of Congress, I'm talking with women of color leaders, actually women at every level. What inspires them? What motivates them? What makes today's leaders lead? Currently, I'm a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, and I'm grateful for their support in the production of this series. You can find more about our work at the Brennan Center online at brennancenter.org. That's BRENNANcenter.org. And we'll be posting our programs on iTunes, on YouTube, and on all the multimedia sections of the website, so there is no way to miss us. Our hope is to inspire people of all backgrounds to take leadership roles in their communities. And joining me in the studio today in Washington, D.C., is Congresswoman Robin Kelly. She represents the 2nd Congressional District of Illinois, which includes Southeast Chicago, some suburbs, and rural areas. She's a New York native, but she came to Illinois to study psychology at Bradley University in Peoria, and she didn't leave. Welcome, Robin Kelly.
Thank you. It's great to see you.
Well, I'm so glad that you could be here with us in the studio. And what I really wanted to talk about is how you came to leadership. I mean, where did you get your start? And forget the politics stuff. How did you grow up?
You know, I was trying to think about that question, but I think some of it is I came from parents who loved me but were divorced, and my father actually raised my brother and I, and which was unusual when you think about my age. And
unusual then and unusual now.
And so I was the woman of the house, really, and I did the cooking and cleaning. I mean, they helped. It wasn't, you know, abuse or anything, but the cooking and cleaning, and my father owned a grocery store. So my brother and I were really on our own. He put a lot of trust in us, and I think that that really helped us to be mature, take care of business, be responsible, and that helped groom us into being leaders.
Well, and so, and then did your mother live nearby?
Oh, sure. My mother was,
oh,
definitely.
Her?
My mother only lived 10 New York blocks away. So we used to see my mom every day. And my mother was a feminist before it was time to be a feminist in a way. A very, very strong woman, spoke her mind, took charge when she needed to take charge, but not really bossy, but just a strong, confident woman.
And so, and was your mom an immigrant to the country?
My mom's family came from Ukraine. She was born here, but that's where they came from.
Wow. And so, you know, as I've thought about you and your experience both growing up, but also your experience in Chicago, what, after college, what made you stay there instead of going back home to New York?
Well, the leader that I am, the reason that I stayed there was because I got married. And I did go back to New York a few times, but then, and even after I got married, I actually lived in New York again for 3 years. And but my, it's actually my ex-husband's job took me back to Peoria, Illinois. It wasn't even Chicago. Despite what people think, I've actually never lived in Chicago, only in central Illinois and the suburbs of Chicago.
Well, that gives you a different perspective because you represent parts of Chicago, but you also understand the sort of, you know, suburban areas of that metropolitan region and what it means to represent a district that's so diverse.
Definitely. My district is urban, suburban, and rural. I have over 1,200 farms in my district. And then some parts of my district, unfortunately, we have the gun violence that people hear so much about around the country. So I say I have the city slickers, the suburbanites, and then I have my farmers. But I actually love it.
Well, you know, I mean, you've been quite a leader on the issue of gun violence. And one of the things that I remember about you is during my service in Congress, is you're calling attention to the fact that we can't just pay attention when it comes to sensible gun laws when there are mass shootings, but where there are guns used every day. with Americans who lose their lives. So talk to us about the work that you've done in your district and in the Congress around those issues.
It was very frustrating to me, that we had our moments of silence only when there were mass shootings. But if you died alone, you didn't seem to count as much. And as you know, I don't stand up for moments of silence because I feel like we stand up, we sit down, and we do nothing. But I do feel like I brought the voice to Congress. I talked about the person who died alone, the everyday person. Sometimes we want to give the perception that the people shooting and dying are gang members. That is so far from the truth that maybe the shooter in a particular Chicago area is a gang member, but his victim certainly is not. And also the thing about gun violence, 61% of people that die from guns is suicide. And maybe in some particular areas it's not, but overall it is suicide, and then it's homicide. And also bringing to the table that so many women, as you know, have lost their lives to domestic violence by guns. And then, of course, we have accidents because people don't hide their guns from the kids, or they leave it loaded, or you know, the young person doesn't realize it's a real gun and things like that. So I'm just trying to be that steady voice that you cannot quiet because it is a public health epidemic.
Well, and you have been. I mean, I remember my recollection is that in the Congress when, you know, there'd be a mass shooting and the moments of silence. And as you say, people stand up and then they sit down. You were the first member of Congress who said, you know what, affirmatively, I'm not going to participate in these moments of silence because we're not doing anything. And so I just thank you for your leadership there, because it takes a lot to be kind of the lone voice. Tell me about that.
But, you know, the interesting thing about it, and I'm glad that other people have joined me, but and I do things because I believe in it, not, I want to be on the news about it. But it's interesting, it wasn't until a man did it that it got the attention it got. And I had been doing it, for probably almost a year or something like that, because I just, after the California shooting, I just couldn't take it anymore. I was frustrated when I was standing up, but very frustrating. But slowly but surely, my colleagues, one said, I'm not going to let you sit by yourself. Then it was another one and another one. And then, as you know, because you were a part of it, it developed into our sit-in.
Right. And I just, so I want to go back to that moment because I remember when there was the House sit-in against gun violence, and you coming to the floor making a statement about that, and you chose to make your statement not about the mass shootings, but about the individuals. Right. And I remember you telling a story about one individual who lost their lives to gun violence. Your leadership has been so important there, but you didn't come to leader. You didn't just show up in the Congress. You had put in some hard work as an elected official in the state of Illinois. So what brought you then to Congress?
Well, I had served as a state representative for 4 years and then left. I actually gave up my seat, which is unheard of to most people. And I served as a chief of staff to the Illinois State Treasurer, and then I was a chief administrative officer for Cook County. And then when the opportunity presented itself, I decided to run for Congress. But I've always worked in the area, maybe because of my background, psychology and counseling. I do have a PhD in political science, but my psych and counseling.
Yes, we should say Congresswoman Dr. Kelly.
my degrees in counseling and psych helped me more in this job than the political science, but I've always worked in the area of abuse or violence, whether it was child abuse or domestic violence from a long way back since the 80s, where I was a volunteer or I did counseling or in some cases I had a job. So it's always was something near and dear, to me. And then just when I became a state rep, seeing the young people that died from gun violence is just overwhelming. And then I got very involved with the parents that lost children, and we still, they're very supportive of me. I'm very active with them. We usually, you know, go to dinner at least, you know, once a year. I gather everyone together, but they're really the wind beneath my wings.
Wow, that is, I mean, it's so, that's so powerful to hear because, you know, a lot of times your experience and what you've both lived through, but also in representing people's interests, really provide the foundation
sure.
for leadership.
No, definitely. And, you know, I'm not exactly one that loves to do all the speech making and things like that. So it's a challenge to me, you know, to come on TV, radio, or to give speeches. But I feel like what I'm trying to accomplish is so important that I, you know, I push myself to do it. This is the way you get the word out. This is the way you get volunteers. This is the way you get support.
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, sort of looking at your background. You also come from a family of law enforcement officers.
Yes.
And so how do you reconcile the struggle with, you know, trying to end gun violence, the issues around police brutality, mm-hmm. which have also come up in your district, and your background with law enforcement officers?
I know, it's very interesting, and sometimes in Congress, especially with the Congressional Black Caucus, and rightly so, the things that black and brown, especially young men, have had to deal with, it's been a challenge. But I also know every Thanksgiving I eat with my retired uncle that was a cop in New York City, and I know he was loving and he cared. So you keep that in mind, but he talks about it too. He's honest that there are some people that should not be police officers. That's just the bottom line. We have to do better in evaluating and vetting and people losing their jobs if they do not have the acumen. Police have very tough jobs. They see the ugly in a lot of ways that we don't see. And, you know, like in any profession, even in ours, that, you know, there's people that should be there and a few people that should not be. But it is hard sometimes. But actually, my uncles and my cousins that are in law enforcement, they're the ones that keep me grounded because I know that they're trying to do the right thing. And many other people, I've worked for local governments. I worked with a lot of police officers, but also you know, the good ones have to speak up. But then I get the challenge, you know, do the good doctors speak up? Do the good politicians speak up? Do the good teachers speak up when they see, you know, other things too? Not that that's an excuse, but, you know, that would be helpful. But I've been around many great cops, so that helps me with the balance. But, you know, yes, 16 shots in the cover-up, Laquan McDonald, the third anniversary, it was just last week. So very sobering.
Right. I mean, and I know that, you know, particularly, I mean, a lot of us in representing our districts, I know when I did, you meet an awful lot of really good law enforcement officers who care about their communities. And I think, you know, the challenge is just figuring out how do you root those out so that it doesn't put in jeopardy your loved ones, your uncles, your, mm-hmm. You know, your family members who are
exactly.
law enforcement officers.
Exactly. And we just had a discussion last week in Chicago, and a assistant superintendent of one of my suburban communities spoke, and you really have to do the background check, which is hard because people just say, yes, they worked here, yes, this, yes, that. But we really have to scrub records, you know, because there are just different instances where the police officer got in trouble in one place and then we found out that the other place said he shouldn't be a police officer or don't hire him again, but that wasn't known. So we have to figure that out on a national level.
Right, and just really change the culture of mm-hmm. law enforcement.
Definitely.
So that it really connects with
Definitely.
Community. So thanks for your leadership there. Now, so on a personal level, I mean, you have children, right?
Yes.
And how has it been, you know, you raised your children when you were in sort of public life?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I have a 35-year-old daughter and a 33-year-old son, and I have two stepdaughters that are 30 and 26, and I have a grandson who's 3 that is just a delight.
Well, I just keep saying, you know, for me, raising my son and doing a lot of that in public life, I think Trolls had his body until he was about 22 or 23 and then returned him to me, and he's better, stronger, faster.
You know, I have to say, When my kids were 13, I don't know what happened to them, but when they turned 14, they were pretty good, and they knew because of all my jobs. I was in the public, whether it was director of community affairs and then state rep and on and on and on. You know, I used to say, you got to behave, you know. And my daughter made a joke once in school. Like, she has to look around every corner to see who's watching because people knew, you know, who my children were and are, you know. So even now, I know my son is extreme. They're both protective of me, but my son is extremely protective. And there are places he won't go because, like, if it's a debate or something like that, because he can't take it. You know, my husband's the same way. If they say something and, you know, we're used to it and know how to deal with it, not that anyone loves it, but there's places I will not take him.
Well, it's hard. And when you ran for Congress, you ran in a very campaign. And so there are the ads and all of that. So how do you help them to deal with it? Because as a politician, you got to have a little bit of thick skin. I mean, we know there are other politicians who don't.
Right.
But we know that you have to have thick skin.
Definitely. You know, I just tell them, just ignore it. You know, of course, you know, they're going to say this, that, and the other. But what I had to work with them more on, because it was me and 17 other Democrats, and, you know, they knew some of the other Democrats. So that was a thing that, you know, we're past it now, not to be resentful, can't harbor the resentment, because there's too many things that need to be done in the district and we need to work together as a team, you know. So, but it's easy for me to say, where I, you know, like they say, when you and your husband get into an argument, don't tell your mother or your father kind of thing, because they won't be forgiving. So, you know, that it's kind of like that. But no, they're pretty good. I mean, they bring up things every once in a while. But
Well, I mean, you're pretty tough. I mean, I've watched you in your service on the, is it Oversight and Government Reform Committee? You ask some pretty tough questions. So what's that like?
But the funny thing about it is that everyone always said, oh, you'll never make it because you're too nice. I hear that all the time to this day. But one of my Republican colleagues did come up to me on oversight and said, you know, we don't know what to do with you because you're so nice. Everybody likes you, but you get your point across with the questions. And I said, my parents always raised me, no matter what, to be respectful. And I am respectful of everyone. And then the joke now is that I have popcorn diplomacy because I bring it. People love Garrett's popcorn. That's from Chicago. So I bring some of my Republican colleagues popcorn, and Democrats too. So they say I have popcorn diplomacy. And that opens the door. But not that we necessarily agree, but we just have a respect, you know, for each other. And you know this, we get along better than people think we get along, you know, even though sometimes I want to scream, sometimes I feel they do not care. Like on health care and the gun issue, you know, it's very frustrating. But I don't want to go through Congress being angry every day, you know, some days, but not every day.
Well, and you began to know some of your colleagues in a personal kind of way. I hadn't really heard about the popcorn diplomacy, but whatever it takes for that spirit of bipartisanship.
Some I bring more than to others.
Well, I was thinking about your coming into the Congress, and I think when you came into Congress, you came in the minority. Is that correct? And
yes.
So you haven't had the experience of being in the majority. And
I would
what
love
is that
to feel
like?
It. I don't know, because I don't know anything different. You know, I just look at those who had both. And sometimes I don't know, as it says, it better to have loved than lost than never to have loved at all. So I don't know if you had it, then you lost it. Is that, or if you don't know. But the only thing is I want to have the feeling, because coming from Illinois, a very blue state, I mean, we had super majorities, you know, but it does make you appreciate what you have. But I will say this, maybe I won't say it when we're in the majority, but I hope that when we're in the majority, that we do a better job going forward of handling our power, because to have bipartisan legislation that does not even get called to the floor, or have legislation that has so many signers and it doesn't even get called to the floor when I get elected, just like you, maybe by more votes, you know, and things like that. That is frustrating, especially the bipartisan legislation.
And so what have been some of your legislative priorities? What's on your wish list if you had the ability in the majority? And some people don't understand, in the House of Representatives, its majority rule, very different from the United States Senate.
Right. Well, we've talked about gun violence. I have a few gun violence prevention bills, and some I'm not the author, but like the background check bill or the Charleston loophole. So simple, you know, but they won't let those go through. I have a bill keeping guns out of dangerous hands, like felons. I spell it out, domestic, you know, abusers, at least for a certain amount of time. We have a big healthcare bill, since I'm the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus Health Brain Trust, and we work with the Hispanic Caucus and the Asian Caucus on the bill, but passing the HEA bill, which deals with health care and health equity, is very important. We have some very simple tech bills, and believe it or not, the federal government has programs like federal student aid, things like that on if you have a regular computer, you can see it, but on your phone, you can't. So we're not mobile friendly. Even the initial bidding of contracts is not mobile friendly.
When you even think, when a majority, especially a majority of our young people,
exactly.
I mean, my son doesn't have a laptop, use a computer, he uses
right.
his device.
Exactly. So, and actually, these are bipartisan bills. My Republican colleagues are helping me get them out. I finally got out of Energy and Commerce with the help of Republican dentists, my Dental Act bill, which will bring dental care to low-income and rural communities. So they helped me get it out. So I work in a bipartisan manner as much as I can. But you know, some of the bills, they do not budge. And sometimes I think it's not because they're so against it personally, but because of Big Brother, big money, or what something big, you know, they won't vote for the bill.
Well, and it's, I mean, I think for some of our listeners, I know I've heard as I've gone across the country that people want compromise and
yes.
bipartisanship.
Yes.
I do think that there's more of that goes on in Congress
mm-hmm.
than we hear about on
right.
television.
Well, when it bleeds, it leads, as usual.
That's right. That's right. And so is it challenging in this environment to be a leader, to be a woman leader?
Yeah. I guess I just do my thing. You know, yes, it's challenging. Sometimes there's the frustration when you say it, they don't hear you. But when a man says it, and that is bipartisan, I should say, you know, they hear it a little better, it seems like, or you have to say it a number of times. And as you know, there's still not enough of us in elected office, whether it's on a local level, governors or mayors of major cities or in Congress and definitely in the Senate. So it's still frustrating. I mean, we're making our way. I mean, Nancy Pelosi is the leader. And, you know, we do have leaders, but it is frustrating. And then to be, you know, a woman of color and a leader, that has its frustrations also, you know. So, I mean, there's always some barrier or challenge, but, you know, can't give up. Shirley Chisholm didn't give up. You know, Barbara Jordan didn't give up. And so, you know, I can go on and on. You guys that came before me in Congress didn't give up. So we stand on your shoulders.
Well, I mean, I think about some of the things that you talked about this, that you can do in your district that might not ever make headlines. And if you're not a member who enjoys the headlines, but you have to keep plugging away
right.
to do the work.
Right. And we do so many things. I have a job fair coming up, and this is our fifth one, and we know people have gotten jobs. We do health fairs, not only in my district, but because of my role with the Congressional Black Caucus, we've done them, you know, all over the country. I'm one of the co-founders of the Caucus on Black Women and Girls, and we've been all over the country, you know, with things like that. My staff working with others, we work around the issue of diversity in tech, which is very important now, you know, and especially in light of, you know, the variety of things you've been hearing about on the news. The other part of it in my district, still jobs is very, very important. So that's why we do the job fair. But, you know, we have legislation around giving companies tax credits for training young people, bringing them in. We have to do something to keep stimulating the environment and also helping people with the opportunity to have a job. So, and I like to say nothing stops a bullet like an opportunity, which can be a job, a mentor, furthering your education.
Wow, I love hearing that because I think sometimes people do get the impression that Congress is just about the stuff that takes place on Capitol Hill and not about the real things actually go on in communities.
Right.
So
thanks
for sharing that. You know, I often think about, you know, sort of what is it the legacy that you want to live, whether you're serving in your community, you're serving in Congress. And so I'll just ask you that, too. What would you like to leave in place?
Wow. You know, it's really funny. I used to think about this when I was younger, and I'm not really sure why, but I've always wanted to help troubled young people. And the thing that happens sometimes that young people cannot go back to the neighborhood they came from into that same environment. And I would love to have a big home, you know, loving, nurturing home that some of these young people could go to and live, you know, to just have a new start on life. You know, if I had a lot of money, I would do, I know people are like an orphanage, but just a respite, you know, that they could go to and just have a better footing, I guess.
Well, you know, I know when I was in Congress, I would go around and visit schools at every level. And sometimes young people, especially young girls, would just run up and hug me and I would hug them. And it occurred to me, and I talked to teachers about this, to educators, that some young people never get hugged.
That's right. Never celebrate a birthday, never go out of their neighborhoods.
And never see a leader. And
that's
so
right.
Do you have that experience as well, where you're out in your congressional district, and as a leader and as a woman leader, young people recognize that? Because it was a surprise to me. I was very surprised by that.
Definitely. And actually, I learned it a long time ago with my first husband's nieces and nephews, my nieces and nephews, that I had my nephew with me who was very young, and he asked me, where were we? And I said, Chicago, but he was out of his neighborhood and he didn't even realize, you know, all the different colors of people that live in Chicago, you know, some of the different foods you can eat and things like that. So just, you know, he was, I mean, a change, of course, but he was someone that never really got out the neighborhood, never went downtown. And even now, when I walk into the schools, people are amazed, you know, that, you know, I'm a member of Congress or that I have my PhD and things like that. And not that I ever take anything for granted because it's an honor, but it is 2017, you know, so you think that, oh, it's no big deal anymore kind of thing. But no, it is a big deal. And like you said, people don't necessarily see leaders or women leaders or leaders of color, you know, where they live or in, you know, their family. So that's why it's so important what we do, and also it's important what we do in our districts.
And you know, and that, as you say, not taking it for granted, but also recognizing how special it is, and that then can provide, you know, just the spark that a young person needs to say, you know what, I could do that too. And so do you think about, you know, ways in which, you know, young people can look to their own leadership? How do they find leadership? What do you say to them? Because nobody kind of makes a leader. I mean, you can develop and hone, but you don't make a leader.
It's really funny. One of the symposiums on Black women and girls, we had a saying, woke at any age. And we had from 11-year-old, I think, up to like 70 or 80 in the room. And because some of the young people feel like us more seasoned women don't want to listen to, because what do they have to say? And then, you know, we feel some of the younger folks think they know everything and won't listen to us. So we had a symposium around just that very thing. And it was wonderful to see people listening to each other, their commitment of learning from each other. But I also think that, and I'm just going with my daughter, you know, just being encouraging and empowering. And I think that's also where teachers are so important, because they're around your your children, you know, so much that we take the opportunity, just like we take the opportunity when they do something wrong to discipline, that we make sure that we empower, good job, you know, when it is a good job. I'm not saying be fake about it, but I think that's important. And also exposing kids, giving them the opportunity to succeed.
Wow. I mean, I you know, look at your history and what you've done. And again, I'm just reminded that everybody takes a little bit different pathway to their leadership. And do you ever think about that in Congress? You know, you look and say, well, how did he get here and how did she get here?
Oh,
and that you all got there.
Definitely. And also, I never even thought I would run for office. Never, never, never thought I would run for office. And some people, it was just in their blood. And some people come at, I mean, very few, it seems like, but in their 30s. And then some come, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. You know, it's interesting that happens also. But yeah, it's just we all have our own map, I guess. And, you know, sometimes like I felt I took 2 steps forward and 5 steps back, you know, and I ran statewide for treasurer. And when I lost, I never really thought about that I would run for office again. So when I did run for this congressional seat, it still kind of was a surprise.
Well, my experience has been that losing can be very humbling as well, and that you learn sometimes as much from losing an election or losing a job or whatever the loss is, as you do from actually serving. You know, and you certainly have described that in describing, you know, losing an election.
Oh, definitely.
It's not the end of the world.
Though. No, 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 no. Actually, you know, when I lost, to be honest, like people were behind me crying. And my kids, they were torn up. But I just really said, oh, God must have another plan. And then jumped on a plane and went to Miami. I mean, it, you know, you just, and I feel bad. I felt bad for other people who worked so hard. And, you know, the reason I lost, which I won't get into, you know, like those kind of things. But, yes, you know, you have 50% chance, no matter what the polls say or the whatever, you can win or you can lose, you know. And, you know, that's the way it is. But I just look at it, there's something else around the corner for
me.
Well,
so here's what you described. And I think this is actually really important for our listeners and for women out there not to be afraid because, you know, one door opens, another one closes, you know, or one closes, another one opens. We don't want them to close first.
Right.
But you've described a pathway that involves, you know, a door closing, being shut down in an election, but then another door opening for Congress.
Definitely. And before Congress, another door opened. So I had a job and it was a good job, the best paying job, you know, I ever had. And I used my leadership skills. Every time I ran for office, I really took a leap of faith because I know there's no guarantees. You know, I took a leap of faith, and but then I knew I would be okay on the other end. You know, I may have to start back a little bit or whatever, but I was willing to take that chance, and because there's no guarantees, you know. And yeah, I was thinking, you know, when one door closes, another opens. And as people joke, sometimes the hallway may be a little hellish, but you'll get through. There's light, you know, at the end of the tunnel. And I think sometimes as women, we don't do things because we might be concerned about the hallway, you know, and what's going to happen. Because there's, you know, there's things I thought about, but I felt like I wish I could see the end. But of course, you can't, you know. So sometimes it is a leap of faith. But I, you know, decided to jump a few times.
Well, you know, so we're about ready to close here. But what I really want to say is to you, Congresswoman Kelly, is that I really just admire both your humility and your passion. I can feel it. I can see it. And it's certainly evident in the work that you do in Congress. This is Donna Edwards. We've been having a woman-to-woman Let's Talk Leadership conversation with my good friend from Illinois, Congresswoman Robin Kelly. And our sponsor, of course, is the Brennan Center for Justice. You can find us at brennancenter.org. And Robin Kelly, Congresswoman Kelly, Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you.
A pleasure and an honor.